Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today I'm joined by Jeff Booth. He is the author of the book, The Price of Tomorrow. He was the founder of Build Direct, and he is a big advocate for Bitcoin. And today we have some big topics at hand. We want to talk about inflation, deflation, Bitcoin, crypto, and more. So I want to welcome Jeff on the show. How are you doing?
Great. Yourself, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Great. Yeah, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while. So I got your book, The Price of Tomorrow. I recommend getting it on Amazon or something. Lots of big ideas, I think, that you present. And I'm actually excited to get into this. And before the interview, I asked if you mind if we had a discussion about it, because I want to press into some of your big ideas as well. Before that, I want to ask about inflation. So CPI inflation came in last week at 6.8% year over year. What's your kind of quick take on this? Is this transitory? What do you expect inflation to go, let's say, over the next six to 12 months or so?
Yeah, and if you use the same measure they measured in 81, it would have been 15%. Inflation is being driven by monetary easing, and as soon as that comes out of the market, you'll tip into a deflationary spiral. And so any talk about inflation or deflation has to realize what's natural and what is man-made. And so we're living from a system that is being manipulated to drive prices higher. And I totally understand the reason for that manipulation, because the system would fail without it. So I think it's a red herring. Every time you're actually doing this, you're actually robbing more productivity from the free market, and you're driving. And what would a business do to overcome that? They would have to remove labor faster or reduce prices faster. So they'd automate faster, which would cause the counter effect, more printing. So what's so confusing for people today is this short-term window in a macro environment that's radically changing. And probably the greatest thing is they're measuring a system from the system.
Okay. So it seems like, let me unpack a few of these ideas. So, I mean, you're bringing in kind of a bigger picture where you're saying, okay, there is huge deflationary pressures with technology. And you're saying, if left alone, if there wasn't money printing and all this, you know, loose money, then actually would have a deflationary environment. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Okay. So what does technology do? It increases our productivity. Why do we use it? To save our time. And so when you look at all of the, and how fast technology is moving today, that should be deflationary, as our time is saved as a result of that productivity gain. It's not, because we live in a world where that credit system that we live in must expand forever or face not the deflation I'm talking about, but deflationary collapse as the credit system resets.
Got it. Okay. So, I mean, from what I gather from this, just, you know, quick intro here, is you're saying that you have this huge deflationary pressure with tech. The current inflation that we're seeing is because of massive money printing by the government. But you're saying if that's taken away, then we have this huge deflationary pressure and we'll go into a deflationary spiral, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. So what's the kind of course of action then? The Fed and the government needs to keep on printing money. Do they just need to continue to prop up kind of this inflationary environment, you think?
And that's actually why, if you look at this from a system problem instead of all the actors in the system, you realize that the system can't solve itself. So what should the Fed do? The question is, what would you do, Dave? What would I do if I were sitting in that system that had a spectacular failure, and if you had that debt deflation, that the credit, which is the money that we think is in the bank, it's a credit-based system, and if it starts collapsing, you might as well burn the whole system down. Every bank would fail. Mm-hmm. You would just keep failing as you had an unwind of society, and into that vacuum would run. Dictators would run into that vacuum and blame. It would look pretty ugly. It would look like a depression on steroids, and it would collapse all over the world. So that is one system if you allow the free market to operate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So on that point, so I think probably most people don't understand, you know, I think this idea of a deflationary spiral, but if we take kind of this theory that you're presenting as face value and we say, okay, if tech actually has such deflationary pressure and if the government wasn't printing it, let's say we do go into a deflationary spiral, we have governments with trillions of dollars of debt, like the US government, $30 trillion of debt with, and if we go into a deflationary spiral, that debt becomes increasingly hard to pay back. And people lose faith in the system, in the government's ability to, you know, do anything. I mean, we're talking about massive, you know, chaos, and the it's I wouldn't say the worst of the world, but it's a crazy situation, right? I mean, am I like, yeah.
So no, you're not wrong, and that's and that's actually why that's why in the book too I talk about this as a structural issue, and I try not to get into the blame of who did what and everything else. This is a structural issue. You have two giant forces competing each other. One, and actually, if you just think about demographics is a deflationary force too, as it is populations age. But the greater deflationary force by a long way today is the technological impact, and it gives us more for less. Mm-hmm. But that cannot be allowed to win, or it will win no matter what. But it can't. What's happening is the system's trying to overcome that by printing money. So those are those two great forces that we're seeing in our lives, and we don't see what's playing out because we're in one of those systems, measuring the system from the system. So we don't ask ourselves this. We think housing always goes up forever, and we invest our assets in real estate without realizing that there was $185 trillion essentially created or stimulated in economies over the last 20 years to create $46 trillion of GDP growth. So the question you must ask yourself is, will there be another $185 trillion of credit growth stimulation over the next 10 years to get the same thing? And is that the free market working, or is it people manipulating currency so that we think housing goes up forever? And those are those two forces. But to drive home your point, if you let it collapse, and I think what central bank is fearful of, and rightfully fearful of, if you don't print, no matter what political party you're aligned to, if you don't print, most of the money comes from printing, which is taken from the middle class and poorer and transferred to the rich because they have more assets. Most of that printing creates a system whereby the middle class and poor get kind of further and further left behind as their food prices go up and their housing or the rents go up, and you're transferring power to a very few amount of people by printing. But if you don't, you have this collapse. So it's kind of door number one or door number two, and both are bad situations.
Yeah. Okay, so let's clarify. So we're talking about two different systems. You've got this one system where you basically, you know, are fighting this deflationary force of technology that it's tough to fight against, but you do so by printing money, stimulating the economy with massive amounts. But you have perhaps increasing social divide, perhaps its own social and political instability, you know, coming along with that. But the other alternative is if you don't do that and you head into a deflationary spiral, then basically society collapses. I mean, you have the worst case, you know, in that too. But then that doesn't mean the first system is any better. You know?
So that's actually why, and actually that's why I like debates like this. And so given the facts of where we are, what should we do? Because door number one, a deflationary spiral, what leader would be elected saying, I am not going to print anymore, and I'm going to and I'm going to let the system collapse. And no one would elect that person, because what we believe, we want more than we actually can get through a free market. So we accept kind of a human nature. We'll accept inflation in our, which is a hidden tax. And it's a regressive tax on society's most vulnerable. We'll accept that because we want to believe we can get more than we actually can. So politicians will hide that inflation, and we end up believing that you need 2% inflation or 5% inflation or whatever. We end up believing that you must have a theft in monetary in your money. Your money must be worth less each year to be able to live in a productive society. And it's simply untrue. Now, I understand why it's there from human nature, but it's simply untrue if you look at the facts. But belief patterns persist. So if you asked most people in the world, they would believe, oh, it's okay to have theft of 2%. Instead of questioning the theft, they question the rate of theft. And now when you get, which is naturally builds as you build into these credit bubbles, it can't be repaid. Instead of creating more theft, what you do is you take away the free market, and you have to capture that market into government control.
Got it. All right, we've got a lot of stuff here I want to dive into. So with deflation, what do you say to the argument that if we have deflation, let's say there's literally no inflation and we have a deflationary environment, what would be the incentive to invest? Like, let's say hypothetically, let's say I have like, you know, X amount of, let's say someone has millions of dollars, and it's like, in order to, like, inflation gives somewhat of incentive to invest, meaning I don't want to keep it in cash, because if I keep it in cash, my money is worth less in 5, 10 years, next year too. So I'm willing to take a certain amount of risk, right, in order to get a return on my, let's say, $10 million or so. And so inflation is, let's say, hypothetically, it gives a certain amount of motivation to put the money into the system, to risk that amount, and that by result encourages tech innovation and development, right, going forward. But if it was deflationary and my money, I kept telling me $10 million, and in 1 year, 5 year, 10 years, it's worth more, I don't need to invest. I'll sit back and I will not give that money away. And you have the entire society become unproductive because you don't have people taking risks anymore. What's your kind of answer to that?
See, and that belief, your belief that would happen, is a belief that the only reason I invest is because there's theft in money, and that makes the theft okay.
No, it's not regarding theft at all. It's just purely on the concept of investing, right?
No, I know. Yeah. That's actually, but I just want to pull into. Yeah. So the only reason you invest is because your money is going to be worth less the next year.
I'm saying that's a factor in investing, right? Without you have less incentive to invest.
I can tell you, as somebody who makes tons of investments, owns a bunch of different technology companies, that even if we talked about Bitcoin and why I think it's such a great investment, I make investments all day long. I make lots of different investments. And why do I make those investments? Because I think the rate of return of that technology or company will be greater than a rate of return somewhere else. And it makes no difference on the calculation of where of what I would do based on having inflation, having money lose value. So if I thought my money was going to gain value by 1% a year, and I could make 10% in an investment a year, I would make the investment.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the essence of investing, right? The rate of return you're looking for. But my question is actually on a more kind of taking a step back on, and even questioning, like, can deflation actually reverse advancement in technology, meaning you need investment for technology to go forward. Like a lot of people take technology for granted, like, oh, it always gets better. That's not the case historically, looking back, you know, thousands of years. There have been ups and downs, periods of technological advancement and digression, regression. And a lot of it is on this belief and this thing of, hey, I'm going to invest and then the future is going to be better. I'm going to, you know, get money back. But once you go into deflationary period, let's say it's, you know, for you think it's going to be deflationary for next century, because it's safer to hold money in a sense where there is no tax on holding, it could possibly discourage investment to the point where people start doubting the actual return on investment, because the whole amount of investment in the system is pulling back, and it could be a spiral of basically stopping and grinding investment in technology to a halt because technology will slow and then perhaps it could even regress. I mean, what are your thoughts with that?
Yeah, so, and I think this is why these are such complicated topics, and it's really hard to see if you've grown up in a world where you believe one thing and the world's changing. So it's really hard to see what's happening through this, and so you need to move to that higher level. Is it true right now? Is if you went from a credit-based system that must exponentially grow to grow economies, because it's not real growth. It's the credit that's growing at an exponential rate to be able to almost pretend we're growing, but that's the system we live in. And it will also create technology companies and technology super monopolies way faster. And why? Because those technology super monopolies give more value faster. And if you just take the end of that spectrum, I saw a pinned tweet that you had that about Elon Musk and artificial intelligence and robotics. And if you take that to its extreme, and if you think about the marginal cost of production, what's going to happen with artificial intelligence and robotics, and where you're going to collapse cost everywhere. By doing that, you concentrate all wealth in the super monopolies that own AI and robotics. And so wealth is in the very small hands. And why? Because a whole bunch of population is demanding more for less. And that's what the technology companies are giving them. So that's the path we're on. So that's you're just feeding those faster and faster. And then those companies, effectively, if government doesn't take them back, those companies effectively are government. That's what it would look like. That's what it would look like on that path. But to your point, if you had a deflation, if you had a resetting of one system that was growing at that rate to a new system that was based on hard money, there would be a resetting. Technology would slow down into that reset because people would be, where can I make that rate of return? And people would not be able to compute the difference between the debt collapse, which was just the debt collapse was had to happen anyways, to what was the long-term rate of deflation and then investment in kind of my real rate of return. They would confuse those two things. So, and that's why it's so confusing in this time, because there's a lot of people who believe that the Great Depression was caused by deflation, and Great Depression was caused by debt that had to be reset. It was by a run up of debt that had to be reset, and had to be reset one way or another. And the way to try to reset it created the rise in World War II.
Okay. I mean, I guess with deflation, I think my angle here is, you know, regardless of if we get there, whatever, just the concept of deflation, because one of your big thesis of your book, it's like why deflation is the key to an abundant future, right? So the idea is a very powerful idea that technology is inherently deflationary. It gives more and more value over time just because that's the nature of technology, to be more efficient, to give more value. And so, you know, there's a promise or an a potential for technology to make our lives better, right? And then you, I mean, one of the things I love about your big ideas is you're like, what's going on here? Like, technology is supposed to make our lives better, but everything's getting more expensive. We have, like, you know, people working longer hours. Everyone has to work two jobs or in a family, in a household, just to maintain standard of living. Like, why aren't we getting the benefit, right, of the advances and the wealth created by technology? I mean, I love this. I mean, this is a very provocative point, you know, and but it seems like this, the answer or this idea of a deflationary world, it seems like it would carry risk of, you know, certain risk of like, especially if it's like 2 or 3% per year, like people would just hold on to their money. I mean, who would invest in the stock market at that point?
But what is money itself? Right. What is money itself? I know you're an investor, and you're thinking about it from the investment side of it. But what is money? It's an abstraction of our time. We don't want more money. We want more of what we think money will buy us. Right. So it's an extra, and sometimes what we want more money for is the abstraction of we think more money will give us more love or more control over other people. Or more, but most people, it's not the money they want. It's the value over their time go up over time. That's what money is a placeholder for that. And so when you're destroying the value of money, because people say you should, then when you have corruption in money, you must have corruption everywhere. And so what ends up happening is society breaks because society is trying to figure out why their time is getting stolen. And most of society is stuck in a loop racing against that time getting stolen. And so they're taking bigger and bigger risks in that. NFTs, altcoin, a whole bunch of the gambling that's going on. The stock market is a gambling machine, right? Today it's lost fundamental value because people are trying to escape a system that they know is broken and has to keep going. They can't put the finger on why, but so you have society racing towards that cliff, making the system worse. So that's what it looks like today. And if you fast forward that system, and you see this throughout history, the long arc of history, what happens to people over time when they do that? And you consolidate more and more wealth in very few hands, and take away from others as a result of that, people rise up and they will vote for people who will take back that wealth by force. Mm-hmm. And they will give away their individual rights and freedoms in doing so because laws change to be able to enact that I'm going to take it back by force. And unfortunately, there is no other way out of that system. And so I wrote the book largely because I was searching for a path out of that system for my kids. I don't need more money. I don't need more investment. I don't need more. I have everything I could need. I didn't want to write the book. I wrote the book because these two systems are colliding against each other, and both doors in this door number one, a deflationary spiral, is no good for anybody. Door two is no good for anybody. It will end in revolution and war. Mm-hmm. So I was searching for a door three.
Mm-hmm. Sure. We'll get actually into that a bit more. What I'm actually excited about our discussion is because I want to pitch or actually, see like what is, you know, the answer or a possible answer, you know, to our current situation. So I want to go back into, let's say, 2% inflation. Let's talk about this and hash out some of the ideas here. What's wrong with 2% inflation if a few things? One is if wages can keep up, and if like the inflation is predictable, so fixed income people can plan for that, and you know, it's not, let's say, because if as long as wages can keep up, I mean, one of the big issues is with inflation, typically the lower end, you know, wages aren't keeping up. But if the government can actually play a role in distributing opportunity in society to have wages gone. And there have been points in history where wages have gone up actually quite fast and faster than inflation, even for the lower end. So this isn't something that's like, you know, not unheard of. So what's wrong with 2% inflation if you have a right government who's stewarding that and protecting the lower class through equal opportunity, through, you know, kind of protecting their wages so they're keeping in pace with that inflation?
Yeah, inflation is the same as wage deflation, right? It wouldn't solve the problem if it didn't do that. So if you that transfer that you're talking about to more power in government, and what does government do with that? They get bigger, and government isn't as effective as a free market. And the government has to get bigger and bigger and bigger because you cause that societal collapse. And what ends up happening is exactly what you just asked. I know, because we printed all this money, because we caused this inflation and society's collapsing, people race to government to solve the problem that government started in the first place. And it's all caused because a credit-based system must grow forever. And what that means is, if it doesn't grow, you have a deflationary collapse. And so that credit-based system is exactly against where technology is taking us. And go way long. By the way, one of the points you made when wages rose faster in the Great Deflation at the end of the 18th century, or say late 1800s, and it was a time of massive technology boom. Automobiles, electricity, and the works, and wages grew faster because you were on hard money. If you wind back kind of the why I think this happens, back to Roman times, we've always had technological deflation, but it was a lot slower. And what that meant is, but money itself, let's say money on gold, you couldn't create a system. You couldn't trade gold fast enough. You couldn't get velocity in money. So you had to build a credit-based system, and you had to centralize gold to build a credit-based system on top of it. And what would happen is you put humans in the loop. And by humans being in the loop because of that centralization, we could, in Roman times, you'd clip coins. Right, you'd create inflation by clipping coins, and you could hide it. You could hide the real wage loss, and it took 500 years to reset a currency before wars broke out and reset a currency. The current over the last number of cycles, if you look at these great debt collapses, they happen typically 80 years. I would argue that the U.S. would have failed in 1971. Unless they found a new trick to extend the life of the dollar. And that new trick was tying the dollar to energy, in this case oil. And the US dollar was oil, right? All oil had to be priced in US dollars. So if any country stepped out of that system, they were removed from the financial engine of the world. And so, or invaded. And so how did the U.S. do that? They did it with military might, tying dollars to oil. Today, with where technology is taking energy and the distribution and the diverse of that energy, effectively what's happening is Bitcoin is pricing energy. That's that transition that's happening, and no war machine is big enough to control energy. And it's a different time today. China's a bigger player on the world stage than it was in 1971. There's more competing forces competing for currencies. Mm-hmm. So essentially what would happen, the reason that those currencies failed faster or would have failed faster throughout time, it is, I believe, technology moving faster and faster. And so what you have is a long trend growth moving faster and faster on technology, and technology where we're going requires a currency that allows for deflation, a digitally native currency that allows for deflation. Every other path than what I just said is a transfer of more and more control into government. And if you believe that government can make better decisions in the free market, then that'll be okay for you. I simply don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to get into that as, the answer you're proposing, a currency that's deflationary by nature. But going back to kind of my original thing of what's wrong with 2% inflation, as long as we can, mitigate some of the harms, with wealth inequality or even wage inequality, you get a benefit of perhaps, and this is whether you believe it or not, but if you do see some risk with a deflationary environment pulling back investments into the world and being a major risk, you don't, with at least a modest, inflation rate, you at least, take that risk off the table. It seems like you're saying that even just with a couple percent inflation, you're still having to pump the system with liquidity, with, spending, and it just inflates the whole, credit system and bubble. So, is that kind of your argument there?
Yeah. So today, what I'm saying is it starts at 2%. It can never stop at 2% because you need more and more and more. So what happens right now, why is inflation the rate it is today? And really, if you use the same measure, 15% instead of 7% or 6.8%, why is it 15% right now? And why are houses 33% inflation? And so the things people need more, food, housing, scarce asset, are skyrocketing. And they don't really care if their calculator on their phone is free because they can't eat. And so now you're getting government to come in and say, and by the way, if you want to lens to what this looks like, you want to fast forward to what it looks like, look in China. So what the government has to do to be able to keep the revolution down is elect people who will take it back. And so Ant Financial not going public, is that taking it back? Jack Ma kind of getting taken out of Alibaba, is that taking it up? There is no free market. It becomes an entire government control, and it just moves there. And so today you have financial repression happening. You have negative interest, negative real rate interest everywhere, and you have this inflation rate. And so that financial repression is killing people. It's killing a lot of people. People with assets, they're making more and more money. Their assets are going up. They don't realize that what the real risk, the tail risk, is those assets are going to be seized in a different way, either through revolution or through government intervention. But they believe that that money is how much money they're making, and others, people are kind of the negative externality of that printing. So yes, it can happen. And it's likely to continue as we transfer more power to government to fix the problem that government's starting. So your point is that is actually the natural, that's quite likely the natural course. And if you see what happens throughout history when that happens, when the darker side of humanity comes out when an incentive structure reinforces the darker side of humanity, and that's where that takes us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what I'm hearing, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Just the sheer amount of, government intervention that's needed to, create and prop up some inflationary environment, whatever that is, it's just you need continuous and growing amount of government involvement intervention. You no longer have a free market anymore, and you just basically just piling on risk and risk, you know, as you go on, making the whole system more fragile. Is that kind of?
I say quite often, which snowflake causes the avalanche? And now in the system, everybody's looking at which snowflake instead of measuring the overall system. Mm-hmm.
Got it. All right. So let's go into what you're talking about with Bitcoin. You've said before that, let's say, an accelerating technological growth requires a digitally native currency that allows for deflation. Okay. So can you unpack this? Why do we need a new currency? Why don't we need a new government and system? Why is it just a currency
that we need? So again, we've already discussed the new government, because the new government, most of the revenue has to come from more printing. So if you taxed 100% of all companies' profits in the U.S., you couldn't pay back half of the spending last year. 100%. So there is not enough money to tax. People think that taxes could solve it. There's not enough money to tax to be able to do it. So that financial repression, interest rates, if you could get away with it for longer and you had real rates being negative for a long time, you could solve it from the system. But the problem of those negative rates being like that for a long time, what would China do? Because what you see is what they're doing. They're rational actors as well. We might not think of them as rational actors, but if another country that we're trading with realizes we're going to pay, or I'm in Canada, but U.S., if the U.S. is going to pay back its bills in drastically lower currency, that country would stop buying treasuries, wouldn't it? So in 2016, China stopped buying treasuries and used the money to be able to buy strategic assets, rare earth mines, or strategic assets in the U.S. as well. And as that starts to happen, as you start to break down the world order, as everybody's putting chips on the board because they can't trust money, you start to get the next level of creating enemies, and it's and where what leads to revolution and wars. So that is from the system, and there is no electoral body, either party, from the system that can solve that. It's just math, and it's two systems colliding against each other. So you need a third door. And what ends up happening is, and what I think when I Bitcoin is that is a technology or not deflationary currency, but a currency that allows for deflation. So not and that means that technology will reduce prices. And as more people contribute to that, prices will go down. We have this sense that the most valuable thing in our lives is the oxygen we breathe. If it's more the most valuable, why don't we pay the most for it? And so from that concept, you can realize that that same thing is happening everywhere. So why don't we pay for film and cameras anymore? As the technology makes it abundant, is because technology decreases essentially to its marginal cost of production. And with artificial intelligence and robotics, that marginal cost of production in many cases will be free. So stopping that by putting people into control of money is robbing society of the productive benefits of technology. And unfortunately, no government can make the choice to say, I'm going to take my money and allow it to be deflationary. They will not make that choice. We will not let them make that choice. And so you need to be able to transition a system from the system that can't allow that. And when you look at Bitcoin through that lens, that's what it is. It's something we couldn't choose that allows the a decentralized network to be able to transition from one system to a system we're moving to. And it's a big idea. It's a way bigger idea than most people think when they hear, because Bitcoin kind of becomes polarizing. But if you think about it as a network transition, here's a way I think about it. In 1999, if everybody realized Amazon is growing and selling books and everything else, and you have this technology that reduced access to market and could give you more for less, and people started using it. But if every retail store, including our grocery stores, went broke because of where Amazon was in 1999, there would be riots on the street because we wouldn't be able to eat. So that was, and then as that transitioned, as Amazon got stronger and stronger and stronger and added more products, now we can start to see ourselves in this technology with it. As retail stores close, there's a glide path to the other side. And the market predicting Amazon's rise versus Walmart, Sears, everything else was way in front of predicting that. But most of us using Amazon at the time, we wouldn't have seen that. We would have said at the time, we would have said, I'll go to shop at Barnes and Noble, right? It's a bookstore. We wouldn't have seen what was to come because our minds predict. They don't predict where technology is moving. It predicts our present forward. And so that's what you're having right now. You're having Bitcoin is a system that is moving on a network effect that's getting stronger and stronger and stronger. But most people are predicting where it is right now, instead of what will happen to it. And also the same thing that you're worried about, I'm worried about. What if the system collapsed today? What would happen? So what if the system collapsed? What if we allowed deflation? What would that would look like? Pretty frightening. What if we keep printing? Pretty frightening. And so how do we get out of this thing we can't get out of from the system? And that's what I think Bitcoin becomes.
Okay. So my question though is more on the specifics, like why a digitally native currency versus a new system? Like a currency to me is it doesn't entail, a complex system per se. Because there could be, I don't know, there could be many different types of currencies in the world too, right? There are probably hundreds, and each government has the currencies. You can have even on like in crypto, how many thousands of different types of so-called currencies are there? Just because you have another currency that allows deflation doesn't really mean anything. I mean, are you talking about more an alternative economic system? Is that what you're talking about?
I am talking about the entire thing. I'm talking the rails of Bitcoin.
Okay.
The primary layer is a store of value.
Got it.
The secondary layer on Lightning Network turns into a currency. And it's open and decentralized. Anybody in the world can opt in, and there's nothing that anybody can do to stop that. So you can choose to do it. So you have an open monetary network that's opt in. Now think about how that system would work. I know it's very different than the existing system, and this is why it's so confusing. So if what we're talking about, I'm an entrepreneur, and the only way for me to actually create value for myself on this new network is to actually create value for other people. That fair? So every entrepreneur, the way they create value is if their thing doesn't work, if their experiment doesn't work, if their idea doesn't work, they fail.
Here's my qualm with this is it seems like you're putting Bitcoin into a vacuum where there's no other, things that influence this vacuum of a system, right? Bitcoin, and sure, yeah, if Bitcoin is the only money in this system, only currency, the only, store of value, the only transaction layer, everything, yeah, then of course you have to create some value, I understand that, but we don't live in a vacuum of a world, where you can just suction everything into just Bitcoin and it's unrelated to all of the other currencies and economic systems in the whole world.
Perfect. So let's dig into that.
Yeah.
I think over time, and in this time, that'll look like a crazy, what I'm about to say will look like a crazy statement, but that's what I think it does over time, because what it takes, it sucks into the value of everything. Mm-hmm. Why? Because to compete against it, you have to have a currency that will go into failure. So if you choose your own currency against this, then yes, that will exist for a time. And then it'll turn into what's happening in Turkey right now, or Lebanon right now, and it'll move into fact. And every time you do that, essentially experiments of my currency regime against Bitcoin, or experiments of a free market working against Bitcoin, all of those experiments are driving more on roads to Bitcoin. That's actually what I think is happening. But there will be those experiments. There today, one of the experiments is a digital one or CBDC, and it's essentially money. Control disguised as money, right? So if you use it, you could be cut off from the system like that. You can then be measured on everything. You can, and once you can consolidate that much control into the government, I'd be careful where that goes. But that is, you're right. That is the opposite side of this system, where you're driving artificial intelligence, robotics, more and more labor out of the market. That's being consult, and that labor, as the labor comes out of the market, prices should be falling in lockstep. Instead, they're rising as that productivity is being stolen by government. But all those experiments against Bitcoin will continue to happen. I just don't think they're, in the long run, they're going to be viable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, I've got some ideas on this. So first off, when I look at this, I'll look at it. I guess we're coming to some type of common ground where, okay, we need a system, an alternative system, basically. Right. I would posit that the alternative system needs massive economic value, meaning it needs to be like almost an alternative economy, a parallel economy in some senses, where people actually trade and they, you know, make their living on it. It just drives the livelihoods of, let's say, hundreds of millions of people. And it becomes kind of this alternate parallel economy, more efficient, decentralized, open. It has its own store of value. And to me, that sounds like more like Ethereum than Bitcoin. What are your thoughts?
Okay. So first, then if we agree on that, and we agree we're in a network transition from one system to another, then I agree exactly with what you just said, that the new system, and why would it grow, is because you've dropped the cost and it's more efficient, and you've dropped the cost. And so how does Amazon grow against Walmart in the beginning? How does Google grow against the legacy industry? Technology drops the cost by an order of magnitude, and that creates a rush in of people who are locked out of the old system. And there's more people locked out of the old system who race to the new and create newfound wealth on the new system. That's what you're seeing happen today, specifically on Bitcoin and on the Lightning Network on layer two. Now, why Bitcoin versus Ethereum or any other altcoin? If you think about where Bitcoin started, and it was going after kind of gold as store of value, and how you'd engineer that solution, you would engineer it for decentralization, and you'd engineer it. So proof of work is essentially security of that network, that it's forever taken out of control of other people. If you were competing, if you were number two against that system, if you're an entrepreneur and okay, that's created a whole bunch of value. Where could I create value? And I would have to create value by lowering kind of what, if you look at the end of the spectrum, security on one side and gas fees or expense, you create something on blockchain that could go, at that time it was the world computer on blockchain, a different use case, but not engineered for security, not the same engineering for security, engineered to be able to use it and often. Now, my personal belief is the layer one technology, our money, our time, shouldn't be in control of somebody else to make a decision that they could change their mind. And so what that looks like, and that's why it's so important that it's it looks like Bitcoin, and it feels like Bitcoin's already won that layer one. Now, if you're Ethereum and you've engineered for something different, but every other altcoin can come in and lower security more and reduce fees, you're attacked by the top, from the top by Bitcoin, and from the bottom from all of these other coins, as every time you're successful, you spawn off a whole bunch of other competitors who just compete as a race to the bottom. And then at the same time, layer two comes in on Bitcoin, and layer two, where you can have high speeds of transaction speed without impacting layer one, reinforces on top of layer one. So I totally buy that from an investment perspective, that people should be able to make whatever investment they want. I just don't see the long-term value of Ethereum and the rest of the altcoins in this play, because I think tied to money, I think it'll just be easier to build it in layer two, layer three on top of Bitcoin. But I do actually would say 2 years ago, 5 years ago, that didn't exist on Bitcoin. So you couldn't do some of the things on layer two on Bitcoin that you can today. So I totally understand why an NFT ecosystem built on top of Ethereum, and why that's continuing, and why there's a network effect there for that. I just don't think it's a long-term viable option.
Got it. So, I mean, it seems though, like tracking your reasoning, you're betting on Bitcoin, but let me come from a different angle. Hypothetically, let's say, because a lot of it is security focused. You're saying, hey, it's decentralized, the highest security, et cetera. A few points on this. One is, what's more important? Like, I mean, I would say regarding security, would you rather have like the highest security possible, but like not much economic activity on the blockchain or system, or would you have security that's good enough, you know, and doesn't get hacked, et cetera, but you have massive economic value, economic transactions and economic system and value created on this blockchain or system? I would say number two would win, because ultimately it seems like if you're building an alternative parallel economy where what's most important is the actual, like let's say economic activity and transactions and livelihoods and everything created on this, you know, economic system, a digital open decentralized system, I would say usage value created, that's going to trump everything else.
So you might be right. So if Bitcoin wasn't developing in layer two, mm-hmm. if Lightning wasn't maybe you're right. I just don't think you are, and I guess we'll see. But if you look at, so why didn't El Salvador integrate Ethereum? And if you think about the usage right now, massive usage. McDonald's is in El Salvador, Starbucks is in El Salvador, and so now, and they're paying in Bitcoin, they're paying in Lightning wallets, and everybody has Lightning wallets. That's not just in El Salvador; it's moving to. And now major corporations are using this technology and building it. Have you seen the rate of growth of the Lightning network?
Yeah, I have. But when I compare it to Ethereum, it just doesn't compare.
But it only started recently.
Lightning network has been around for a while though, you know?
But I guess when I say it started in a commercially viable it's ready for prime time and being able to roll out.
I mean, I guess the point being is, if I was to, I'm not taking sides per se, because I think Bitcoin has its, you know, use case and value. I'm just saying, if you're betting on a new system, a new economic digitally open decentralized system to, you know, kind of steward a deflationary, you know, environment, etc., I would say, like, wouldn't you just bet, like, for example, you've started companies, I've started, you know, my share as well, and it's like, it's fierce, you know, like the startup world is extremely fierce, and everyone has a great idea, everyone has, you know, the perfect, you know, deck, etc., but it's the people who, and the companies that have traction, that actually, you know, have momentum, because it's a flywheel. Once you have traction, doors open, it compounds. It's like this machine that's hard to stop. And it seems like, wouldn't you just go for the blockchain that has the most economic value, like the transactions happening right now, as the lead candidate, versus, because I guess the critique with Bitcoin would be, hey, it's moving too slow. The technology, it takes forever to, you know, to change or to adapt. And while Bitcoin is just like trying to decide on its whatever next thing, it's like these other blockchains, and it's not just Ethereum, but even others are just pressing ahead with innovation that is becoming like the next generation of efficiency, you know, next generation of the rails of a, what an economy can be built upon. It just seems like, I don't know, for me, it's not as clear as, I'm not even pitching Ethereum as the clear winner either. You know, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just curious why Bitcoin is such a clear kind of, you know, topic for you.
So we both agree that the system can't change. So I just want to just check with you. Sure. We both agree that the system can't change itself, and there needs to be a parallel system that is going to emerge to be able to transition. Fair?
Well, to clarify that, I actually think the parallel decentralized, open, digital, kind of more efficient economic system is basically, it's a foregone, like it's going to happen. You know, you can't, it's technology, you know, disrupting, you know, basically the whole system, you know, combined.
Yeah, all we have is creative destruction coming for money.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say, I think the idea of money though is a bit too narrow-minded, in a sense where I look at it as a whole economic system that's being disrupted. Meaning it's not that the fiat and traditional finance system is going to be destroyed. And it's still, there's always going to, I think, be a place for quite a long time for that. It's just that you'll have an alternative, more efficient, decentralized digital economic system that just takes off like crazy and makes the old system more irrelevant over time, whereas people just do most of their economic activity, their investing, their store value, their savings, their transactions, all on this new economic system. And just for me, it says like, who is the best contender for this? I have a hard time thinking, like, for me, Bitcoin does play a role in that. It feels like perhaps a store value, kind of like a gold type of role, but the actual rails of the economy, it's like, I'm not seeing Bitcoin being as innovative as it needs to be to play that kind of mantle role. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I disagree. But it would be easy to, but I totally understand why. And I may be wrong, right? And I'm always looking to check in that, and I see the innovation happening in the space and a whole bunch of other coins, but I don't see their long-term benefit. If I'm just saying from a business perspective, and if I'm on a business, I asked somebody this that I'm coaching, and said, okay, so he's creating this NFT and a new studio and that's essentially using technology to be able to take down studio costs and production by a lot, like a gaming engine into studios. And he wants to finance through NFTs. And I said, and he's picking which one, and he didn't pick Ethereum because of the cost. And then he's going down the road. And I said, so you sell a whole bunch of these NFTs, and then this company you're betting on, or this altcoin that you're betting on, fails. What happens to all the NFTs for the things that you've sold? And so you have this race to the bottom everywhere in all of these. And I do understand how people are trying to create value there. I totally understand. And maybe there's some value to be created there. But if you can't tie it back to sound money principles, which I think is what ends up happening. I think what's going to happen, what is going to happen on layer two and three on Bitcoin, now that it's accelerating, I think you're just starting to see that. I think it's, to me, Bitcoin is TCP/IP, it's the internet. And on top of that, you may be right. So maybe it's a whole bunch of other value on a parallel internet, but I think that's what it looks like. And then on the second layer and third layer, it's going to reinforce Bitcoin's value as a store of value.
Got it. Okay, so here's some other thoughts on Bitcoin, in the sense that okay, and I love kind of the feedback and talking about this. This is fascinating stuff. To me, it seems like Bitcoin inherently, it's the value proposition comes a lot from its security as being the most secure. Like you'll never lose it. You'll always have access as long as you remember your key, et cetera. No one can take down the network, has, the most hash power, just the most secure network, right? But when I look at that value proposition, I feel like it could be at risk in the future where all money and all stores of value, in my opinion, can be at risk of being disrupted by technology. And what I mean by this is this: before, when you had cash or this so-called currency or savings, it was hard to quickly, in one half of a second, switch it over to some type of digital asset that you could maybe be inflation protected or maybe even make some money and then switch it back another half a second or even programmatically do it. All of this stuff is like, it just wasn't there before. And what we see now with this whole advent of not just blockchain, but and digital currencies and assets is we have for the first time the ability where you no longer actually have to hold cash because you can just quickly just convert it over to something else and then convert it back whenever you need to spend the money. And in 5 or 10 years, it's going to be instant. You don't have to, it's just be programmatically all done. You don't even have to have any so-called fiat cash at all, right? It could just be, you get something, it programmatically moved over and moved back whenever you need it. In that case, it seems like you could connect whatever these so-called assets you transition into to actually real assets. Meaning, for example, you tokenize the S&P 500 or something, where I take my paycheck, but then it programmatically instantly converts it to some type of tokenized, let's say, thing backed by the S&P 500. And whenever I spend it, it just converted right back. And now I have kind of this real profit-producing asset that's backing, right, this asset that I hold. So the whole notion of holding cash, holding savings is being disrupted. And to me, this is a huge risk factor for governments as they're.
So this whole thing is a risk factor for governments. Like so you have, go back to Bitcoin for a second. So you have a technology or any of the cryptocurrencies. The one thing that's different about Bitcoin, and so it doesn't have a council that decides. You can tell it's decentralized by that, but it is a risk for governments because for governments to be able to opt into that system, what is also it's a benefit for governments too that move early, but it's a risk because effectively they have to tell you the truth. They have to say, I can't hide any more money in inflation. The government gets smaller as a result, as the free market and we have more individual rights of the free market. Now, I'm not so on a side that says there shouldn't be any government. I want firefighters on my street. I'm happy to pay for services, but I would rather hear the truth. And I would rather vote on the taxes I should pay and the ch choices I should make in a society based on the truth rather than a lie that picks a pocket of somebody else. That's the point. And so, but to your point, it has massive implications because if you look at the credit markets and if you look at the credit markets on housing and everything and what ends up happening, the reason that this exists, the reason it exists, and you get more and more is you have to take more, and government has to get bigger as a default in the existing system. And this is the opposite. It's a totally different system. That put it, is it any surprise that somebody, a country like El Salvador, went first? From a you're a technologist, I'm a technologist. Is it any surprise? And if you think about what technology does, is it favors the people most blocked by the existing system, because it changes the rules. And so it opens the door to all the people left out. So if you look around the world and you see all the countries left out, they don't see what you and I see every day. They don't have a system that their credit card works everywhere, and it's only 2% instead of 12% fees for the business. They don't see the same thing. They are locked out of that system. So is it any surprise that when you lower the barrier cost on an open network, mm-hmm. that can drive innovation faster into it? It's no surprise that a country like El Salvador went first. And just like it wasn't the people in Walmart store, it wasn't all the suppliers to Walmart that went to Amazon first.
Yeah.
It was the ones that were left out of the stores. And there were more people left out of the stores than were in the stores. So Amazon, it was a bottom-up movement, just like Google, just like Amazon, just like all technology, because technology changes the cost structure so radically that people who are left out move to it faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think my point in the sense of the whole thing of money and store value being disrupted, and you have the kind of tokenization, instant transfer of, you know, let's say value anyone to anyone, like even from, you know, from fiat, et cetera, to wherever. It seems like that could be actually a risk factor for Bitcoin as well. And what I mean by this is, if Bitcoin's main value proposition is so-called store of value, at least on layer one, and on security, then if you have a different type of store of value, which is, hey, I could take my, you know, cash instead of putting in a Bitcoin, which is a very volatile asset inherently because it's very just supply driven, you know, more people want it, goes up, you know, et cetera. And vice versa, more people are selling it. So rather than that, I say, hey, I could just stick it into, you know, a digital token that's pegged to the S&P 500, and that's a more stable in terms of its, let's say, hypothetical, let's say, profits, at least for this year and, you know, next year, et cetera. And it seems like that type of, and once you have not just S&P 500, but you have thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of possibilities to transfer your money into stores of value, digitally, decentralized, et cetera, then it seems like Bitcoin was innovative and novel as the first kind of secure store of value. But where is that role when you have like just a plethora of more stable stores of value in the future?
So you're mistaking stability for so every single technology company is upwardly, like when it starts, like Amazon, how many people held it at $5 to where it is today?
Probably one.
Tesla, same thing.
Sure.
So technology companies are upward, they have giant drawbacks, as people are betting on the future and everything else. And then now to compare that to Bitcoin, if you took your Bitcoin out at any time, any year, and said put it in the S&P 500 and then transferred it back into Bitcoin, how did you do? Bitcoin, so if measure the S&P in Bitcoin terms, and you'll see everything is coming down in price forever.
I mean, that's all past though.
Okay, but again, what I'm getting at is, if you're right, if there's a superior store of value, then you'll be right, Bitcoin won't work. I don't think that that's going to happen. What's creating is a whole bunch of people who believe that and are betting on it, and a whole bunch of other people rushing into the superior store of value in Bitcoin, and it's reinforcing it. Bitcoin's in the news all the time because of this. And if you look at the rate of growth and wallet growth on Bitcoin, it's is proving itself stronger and stronger and stronger as that store of value. Now, it could there be something else? But I tell you, if I had to pick a house, my house, that's versus Bitcoin, yeah. or the house versus Bitcoin, I tell you which one I'll pick, right? The
sure. I mean, what are you judging the criteria on Bitcoin as being a superior store asset? I mean, you mentioned, you know, past performance, but let's say take the past year, Bitcoin, you know, isn't even probably in the top 10, you know?
Well, so versus the S&P?
No, versus any, versus like all of the other top, let's say 10 cryptos.
Yeah. And in a short-term window, there will be cryptos, but people will make those bets, no question. And there's going to be some, I think, in a longer term path. I'm comfortable with, I guess in Bitcoin specifically,
yeah.
that my main thesis in my book and otherwise, nothing has changed. It's only reinforced that. Mm-hmm. If I were to see something that I thought had longer term value, than that digital scarcity that couldn't be corrupted or taken or didn't have a council, I don't think it's possible. But I will, if we're debating this, could I be wrong? I could be wrong.
Yeah. It just seems like, you know, I mean, I understand, you know, past performance 10 years, but even if you take just the past 3 years, you know, there's probably a ton of, you know, actually, yeah, a lot of cryptos come to my mind right now that the past even 3 years have outperformed Bitcoin significantly. And so it seems like past performance shouldn't be the biggest indicator of, you know, the future performance either, right?
In that case, so ask yourself on a new starting from a zero base. I do I get my friends together and I call it Jeff Coin, and I have 70% of the economics, and I get with my friends, and I sell this thing off. And from a small base, I could create a whole bunch of momentum to create huge returns on a Jeff Coin.
Sure.
If I measured it in a year,
yeah.
The question is, what long-term value does it provide? And I don't see the long-term value in these coins. By the way, I've been asked, not yeah. Jeff Coin, but I've been asked to, let's design this constantly. But I can understand, or you get some of the right people around it and say, this is what this will do, and you have a run-up. But from a smaller base to where it's going, and I think the dynamics and how these are built, I think they'll all run into the same problem. I think as they get bigger, they can't scale, and so you're just going to have this cycle that's going to continue. The internet itself had a whole bunch of blowups on the internet and itself, and it made the entire systems stronger. I think that's what's happening today.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. For me, it seems like, you know. If we're talking frameworks of how do we value or the best, let's say, blockchains or potential for this alternate system, you know, I would say one framework would be like, hey, which blockchain has the most economic activity right now, you know, and growing fastest, right? Who's in the pole position in terms of that? I would say, you know, that probably has the best chance. Not guaranteed by any means, but it just seemed like that's that type of simple framework would probably not lead to Bitcoin, though. That's the problem I have. See, Bitcoin.
I disagree. So if you're in an economic system, if you're measuring an economic that a whole bunch of people are trying to escape that through taking higher risk, that higher risk, including a bunch of the economic value driven from NFTs, would be in that bucket. And that would go away really quickly if the system wasn't printing money to create that. It's not a whole bunch of long-term economic value. It's people gambling to try to get out of the system. But it could create a tidal wave of people doing it, because and so you add social media to that, you say, somebody that had this wallet over here changed it to a different wallet to sell it to themselves, but tell the world that they made $5 million on this NFT, you'll create a whole bunch of younger people leaning into that, saying, wow, I can make that much money too. And yeah, you can get a whole bunch of economic activity that isn't lasting economic activity. That's where we would disagree on what I think is what you're seeing in that whole altcoin ecosystem versus what I think you're seeing in Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, I think, it just seems like from my exposure, I mean, there are a lot of obviously kind of, you know, shady and non, let's say, sustainable, you know, economic endeavors on different blockchains. But there are actually a lot of, I think, very significant ones. And it just seems like, for me, it seems like Bitcoin still has a chance, but this lightning network needs to take off like nuclear. It really needs to, because I'm telling you, there's like other blockchains like Ethereum and Solana and others that are just experiencing such, you know, radical growth that Bitcoin has to own up to, and they have to live up to this, you know, their so-called pole position in crypto. And I think for me, it's still undecided whether blockchain or Bitcoin becomes just, let's say, more of a narrow use case of a digital store value, or if Bitcoin becomes so-called this all-encompassing, let's say, economic parallel economy, right? Or if that's relegated to another, let's say, more innovative, you know, blockchain or not. Or if like, yeah, like it, I mean, there's so many roads and different, you know, paths. And yeah, I mean, I could see a case for each one, you know. I'm not, yeah, obviously,
so,
yeah.
So again, we're literally living in a free market, and the mm-hmm. market will tell us.
Yeah, exactly. What's right.
And at a way higher level, Dave, here, I'll go back to why I wrote the book in the first place. I believe we're in a system change that most people can't see. And I believe that we need for the technology to not our productivity not be stolen, and us essentially being slaves to a system that's working harder and harder into a system to be able to capture that we need a currency that can be taken out of control of the government, that creates game theory that they need it too. The early movers on that reinforce it because they win more of the game. And by doing that, I think we transition from a system that humanity's always known that has always looked the same, that is ended in revolution, war, and reset, where government said we promise we won't do it again, and then happens again, to a new system that is congruent with where we're going with technology. That's what I believe.
Sure.
And out of anything I've seen, still today, I haven't seen anything but Bitcoin that takes us there.
Yeah.
Because the others, including Ethereum, you have to have a council to make decisions. And if you have to have a council to make decisions, you're essentially trusting a group of people to not change the rules. And so with that, I would rather put my time and energy into something that I believe can make a transition for all of us than something that makes me a whole bunch of money in a bet. And even if that bet goes to zero, but I like to think about, we are all, everything we see around us, including the system we live in, was only an idea first. And when enough people believe in an idea, we change. Mm-hmm. So we're going through a radical change in society, and it's hard to see that change, how big that change is, from the system itself.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the way I kind of look at it is, it's very interesting. I mean, we have a lot of, you know, similar veins of thought here, but I look at it from, rather than from starting from the kind of current system, I kind of look at it as, you have this massive progression of technology, that and cryptography, the internet connected world, value, money being disrupted, just everything being tokenized, everything, where it's the right time where for the first time in history, you can actually have a full blown, like, global digital economy outside of the realm and the outside of the kind of the hands of governments, right, regulating it. And this, if it happens, and well, it's already happening, but as it progresses exponentially, which most people don't understand that concept, like how fast it can grow and the implications, but as it does that, it can actually be one of the most fundamental changes in our lifetime or generation or perhaps history, because you're creating what has never happened before, you know, an entire economic system outside of, you know, the reach of the government, which is by nature this system, because it's open and decentralized and digital, it's more fair, it's more efficient, more vulnerable or transparent. I mean, it's you have better forms of ownership, you know, that you can hold on. All of the negatives of the current system, all of the corruption or the inequalities, the oppression of the current system, a lot of that can be, you know, it's not inherently present in this new digital open system, because with openness, you get rid of a lot of that, you know, the corruption and the unfairness. And as a result, if this happens, you have more and more economic activity, more and more value, more and more store value, et cetera, being put into this alternative system, the government starts to lose power, because their fiat currency and regulation loses power.
So that's kind of what I think today. Mm-hmm. You see, from a system lens, you have people look at San Francisco, look at some of these cities, and what would happen from that system lens? So that's created by essentially picking the pocket of the middle class and poor, and more and more loss of their real income, and they move into hopelessness, street crime. What will people vote for? Those people will vote for more government services to give them money to expand government. The other side of the ledger, in your seat, many of your friends will vote for more protection from those people, giving government more control. That's what this looks like, and it's all caused by that same thing is happening globally. Versus now on Bitcoin or on a blue wallet, I have a business in India. I have a big business in India, six-figure wire transfers, the fees, the everything. A couple of weeks ago or 3 weeks ago took 3 weeks as bank, and this as a, I can just pay people directly. And so you have individuals globally moving into a new system, and into that new system, it's really hard to stop because it's open, it's network.
Yeah, definitely. I think I appreciate a lot of your insights and your book and your interviews, because you're connecting it to kind of, you know, the current kind of credit system, the inflationary environment and what's going on, linking it to kind of a bigger meaning and purpose for technology and, you know, crypto and blockchain. It seems like there is like this deeper, perhaps, significance where a lot of people are just, you know, just influenced by the noise, you know, of crypto trying to make money here and there. What's the latest, you know, thing to trade, et cetera. But to me, there's something more fundamental going on. It's a social, political, economic,
I love that you're saying that, mm-hmm. because actually that's it. And maybe for on Bitcoin, maybe what makes my voice heard in Bitcoin, I don't need any more wealth from it. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Like everything, this, what we're doing right now is I do this for free. I have a whole bunch of businesses and everything. My time is not, I'm not trying to sell more books. I'm not trying to, sure. It's not something I care about it for a different reason. And it's that reason that is more important. We could disagree. Now I get how people, if they have all their wealth in Ethereum or Cardano or any of the other ones, how, or Bitcoin, how people would get really polarizing on this. Mm-hmm. I'm not in it for that reason. I'm in it for the structural change because we need a structural change.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I see. Yeah, definitely. And this is one of the reasons why, or the main reason why, it's fascinating what we're going through, how technology is not just disrupting, like, you know, gadgets or, you know, our appliances or phones, but it's going much deeper in bigger ways, you know? And it's a kind of a, different mashups are being put together, right? You have the internet, cryptography, you know, economics and trading and assets and all this stuff just being layered, and then startups just piling on with innovation upon innovation. Exciting time to be around. Especially in the next few years, next 5 or 10 years is going to be absolutely crazy.
It's wild. Yeah. Like positive in some ways, negative in some others. But the system transitions are never easy. But being on the right side of those system transitions and seeing a framework from a different from the new system is a better is a better spot to be.
Yeah.
I just leave a bunch of your audience with this. Mm-hmm. If you believe, and I know you do too, if you believe where technology is moving with self-driving cars, robotics, and artificial intelligence, and if you see how fast it's moving there, what jobs are safe? And a whole cascade of jobs that we take for granted that our job will always be safe are not going to be safe anymore. Now, then maybe that takes 10 years, 20 years to play out. Maybe it takes 50 years to play out. But that thing that's happening is what's creating, in an environment where you must push prices higher and higher and higher, is driving fear into giant parts of the population. And they're trying to figure out, how do I hope for my family future and everything else? And you're seeing this. That is why, specifically, why a currency, a global currency that allows us to transfer value like that, must allow for deflation. Because otherwise, because otherwise, you're going to light the world on fire through that fear.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Thank you, Jeff, for the time. I'll go ahead and refer to your book one more time, The Price of Tomorrow, on Amazon. And I know you have a ton of actually interviews on YouTube. You just type in Jeff Booth, and you can watch them. Any other places? Twitter, obviously, you have a large following on Twitter. People, I'll go ahead and link to the video description.
For me, best is just Twitter.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. Awesome. Thanks, Jeff, for the great conversation. And I appreciate your time and all the efforts you're doing, pushing our world one step forward. And it's great meeting you as well.
Thanks, Dave. You too.
Okay. All right. Bye.